The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We'll begin this week with an article by Shelby Copeland titled 35 Patriotic Quotes to Share This 4th of July. If you're like most people, you probably celebrate the 4th of July with a delicious barbecue spread, not to mention equally decadent desserts, a playlist of the country's finest tunes, hello, Born in the USA, and all the red, white, and blue decor you can buy or do it yourself. But with all the fun festivities, from patriotic parades to dazzling fireworks displays to backyard bashes, it can be easy to lose sight of what the holiday is really about: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. After all, the annual celebration of freedom commemorates the passage of the Declaration of Independence, which was written by some of the country's founding fathers, like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. So, to help you celebrate America's big birthday, we've compiled a list of the best and most patriotic quotes. Some come from former presidents, while others were uttered by their equally impressive spouses, as well as history-making activists and leaders. And one even comes from Lady O herself. During a keynote speech at the opening of the Statue of Liberty Museum, Oprah said, "We live in divisive times, but I think it's only fitting that at this critical moment, we remember that the one idea that sustains the soul of America above all others is freedom." President John F. Kennedy: "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," the former president said during his inaugural address in 1961, according to the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum. President Franklin D. Roosevelt: "According to the FDR Library, during the 74th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, the former president said, 'In the truest sense, freedom cannot be bestowed. It must be achieved.'" President Barack Obama: "During the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech in 2013, the former president said, 'In the face of impossible odds, people who love their country can change it.'" Oprah Winfrey: "It's important that we establish that we are a country that has open arms and not closed borders for people. It's important because we let people know why America is what it is. It's about an ideal, and that ideal is freedom for everybody," the O of O said during her keynote speech at the Statue of Liberty Museum opening gala in 2019. Calvin Coolidge: "According to the Calvin Coolidge Presidential Foundation, the former president said, 'Patriotism is easy to understand in America. It means looking out for yourself by looking out for your country.'" Michelle Obama: "The fact is, with every friendship you make and every bond of trust you establish, you are shaping the image of America projected to the rest of the world," the author of Becoming and former First Lady told students in 2011. Bono: "America is not just a country, it's an idea," the Grammy-winning singer and U2 member said during his 2004 commencement speech at the University of Pennsylvania. Bill Clinton: "During his first inaugural address in 1993, the former president said, 'There is nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America.'" Malcolm X: "You cannot separate peace and freedom, because no one can be at peace unless he has his freedom," the civil rights activist said during a 1965 speech. Harry S. Truman: "America was not built on fear. America was built on courage, on imagination, and an unbeatable determination to do the job at hand," the former president said to Congress in his first economic report, according to the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library and Museum. Robert Frost: During a conversation with NBC in 1952, the American poet said, "Freedom lies in being bold." Condoleezza Rice. The essence of America, that which really unites us, is not ethnicity or nationality or religion. It is an idea, and what an idea it is, that you can come from humble circumstances and do great things, the former Secretary of State said during her 2013 speech at the Republican National Convention. James Baldwin. In his book, Notes of a Native Son, the novelist, playwright, and activist wrote, "I love America more than any other country in this world, and exactly for this reason. I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually." Madeleine Albright. The magic of America is that we're a free and open society with a mixed population. Part of our security is our freedom, the former Secretary of State told Oprah Winfrey in the December 2001 issue of O. Paul Tsongas. During a 1991 campaign speech, the former Massachusetts congressman said, "America is hope. It is compassion. It is excellence. It is valor." J.S.B. Morse. "I don't believe in the Constitution because I'm American. I'm American because I believe in the Constitution," the American author wrote in his book, Gods of Ruin. Amy Tan. In America, nobody says you have to keep the circumstances somebody else gives you, the Joy Luck Club author Amy Tan wrote in her memoir, The Opposite of Fate. John McCain. In his farewell letter to the country, the former U.S. Senator John McCain said, "Americans never quit. We never surrender. We never hide from history. We make history." Valerie Jarrett. The senior advisor to former President Barack Obama said to the Spelman College class of 2017, "For change often seems impossible until it is inevitable. Just as we must own our lives, we must own our country. For we, the people, are ultimately in control of America's story." President Franklin D. Roosevelt. In a collection of his letters and addresses, former President Franklin D. Roosevelt said, "The fate of America cannot depend on any one man. The greatness of America is grounded in principles and not on any single personality." Frederick Douglass. "The life of the nation is secure only while the nation is honest, truthful, and virtuous," abolitionist leader and orator Frederick Douglass said during his speech on the 23rd anniversary of emancipation in D.C. in 1885. Richard Rorty. In his book Achieving Our Country, American philosopher Richard Rorty said, "National pride is to countries what self-respect is to individuals, a necessary condition for self-improvement." President Jimmy Carter. "Human rights is the soul of our foreign policy, and I say this with assurance because human rights is the soul of our sense of nationhood," President Jimmy Carter said during his Universal Declaration of Human Rights remarks at a White House meeting commemorating the 30th anniversary of the Declaration's signing in 1978. President Barack Obama. Former President Barack Obama said, "Our Constitution is a remarkable, beautiful gift, but it's really just a piece of parchment. It has no power on its own. We, the people, give it power. We, the people, give it meaning with our participation and with the choices that we make and the alliances that we forge," during his farewell address to the nation in 2017. Thomas Wolfe. "America, it is a fabulous country, the only fabulous country. It is the only place where miracles not only happen, but where they happen all the time," American novelist Thomas Wolfe said in Of Time and the River, A Legend of Man's Hunger and His Youth. Martin Luther King Jr. "I say to you that our goal is freedom, and I believe we are going to get there because, however much she strays away from it, the goal of America is freedom. the minister and civil rights leader said just days before he was killed in his sermon, "Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution." President Ronald Reagan. Down through history, there have been many revolutions, but virtually all of them only exchanged one set of rulers for another set of rulers. Ours was the only truly philosophical revolution. It declared that government would have only those powers granted to it by the people, the 40th U.S. president said while delivering remarks to propose a new economic Bill of Rights in 1987. Mitt Romney. In his closing argument in the 2012 election, Senator Mitt Romney said, "Americans don't settle. We build. We aspire. We listen to that voice inside that says we can do better, a better job, a better life for our kids, a bigger, better country." Eleanor Roosevelt. True patriotism springs from a belief in the dignity of the individual, freedom and equality, not only for Americans, but for all people on earth, universal brotherhood and goodwill, and a constant striving toward the principles and ideals on which this country was founded, the former First Lady said in her book, Eleanor Roosevelt's Book of Common Sense Etiquette. Coretta Scott King. Freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation, Coretta Scott King said in My Life with Martin Luther King Jr. Arnold Schwarzenegger. While recalling becoming a U.S. citizen, actor and former California governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said, "There is no second-tier citizenship. You are an American, period. With hard work, learning English, and getting involved, there is no limit on what you can achieve." Hillary Clinton. In her remarks to the veterans of foreign wars, the former senator and secretary of state said, "But I have never lost faith in America's essential goodness and greatness. I believe no challenge or threat is too dangerous or difficult for us to meet if we work together, if we have sensible policies, if we cross the partisan divide that too often substitutes for reason and come together around our shared values and a commitment to that future we want for our children and grandchildren." Margaret Thatcher. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher said in a speech to the Aspen Institute, "I am an undiluted admirer of American values and the American dream, and I believe they will continue to inspire not just the people of the United States, but millions upon millions across the face of the globe." George William Curtis. A man's country is not a certain area of land, of mountains, rivers, and woods, but it is a principle, and patriotism is loyalty to that principle, American writer and speaker George William Curtis said. Tom Brokaw. American TV journalist Tom Brokaw said in the 78th commencement speech to Connecticut College in 1996, "These are moments to be cherished in American life, the realization of a common dream, unique really to this land, a college education, a privilege not confined to the well-born or wealthy. Here the working class sits side by side with old and new fortunes. Here new Americans from distant lands and cultures mingle with the sons and daughters of Americans who came on sailing ships, some to proclaim their freedom, others in the holds and chains of slave ships." Our next article by Lee Woodruff is titled, "My Husband's Near Death Taught Me Gratitude." My life imploded with a phone call. While reporting from Iraq, my husband had been hit by a roadside bomb. Critically wounded, shrapnel to the brain, might not make it through surgery. I could barely absorb the meaning of the words. He was transferred to the military hospital in Landstuhl, Germany. When I got there, his room was meat locker cold to minimize swelling. Bob lay naked on a bed, partially covered by a sheet. His body white as marble, still as a sculpture. For a moment, I let myself believe he was asleep, but his head was pockmarked with shrapnel wounds, a ragged trail of staples closing his scalp over a horribly distorted brain. 72 hours later, he was flown to Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he'd be comatose for 5 weeks, eyes open without seeing, moaning without speaking. My world shrank down to caring for our four children, all of them under the age of 14, and waiting for their father to wake up. One day, out of the blue, he did. Bob couldn't recall who was president of the United States, but he could say Mohammed Ahmadinejad. We were elated that he could talk at all. At a rehab hospital in New York, he began the grueling work of relearning how to string sentences together, read, and write. That's where my euphoria started to fade. I sat across from him as the therapist held up a plastic head of lettuce. "What's this called?" she chirped. "Salad?" Bob's eyes darted toward me apologetically. I smiled, trying not to mouth the right answer. After college, I'd fallen in love with his inquisitive mind, the fact that he could speak Mandarin and easily explain things like the Six-Day War. Bob was here and not. A month and a half later, thin and tired, he walked through our front door. The twins ran in to hug him, waving welcome home signs made with crowns and glitter. We were a family again, snuggling on the couch, watching hours of TV as the children touched the places on his face, where shards of shrapnel were still working their way out. With the fear of Bob dying in full remission, tricky emotions filled the void. Just weeks before the explosion, he'd taken over for Peter Jennings as co-anchor of ABC World News Tonight. His recovery would be lengthy, the outcome uncertain. How would he cope with the death of that dream? And what of the hard work we'd both invested in his career, constantly pulling up stakes and moving to yet another city as he made his way up the ladder? If he could no longer work, how would we raise four kids on my freelance copywriter income? I felt like a shrew even thinking about money. In his early recovery, everyday moments felt like a series of paper cuts. The joke he didn't get, the conversation that ricocheted around the dinner table too fast for him to follow, the meeting with our lawyer who'd advised I take control of our assets until things stabilized. "I don't understand," Bob said, looking up from a pile of papers as the lawyers awaited his signature. "Why is everything in my wife's name?" His confusion was a gut punch. For months, I'd been pumping out good vibes like a cheerleader, staying upbeat for the kids, arranging my supportive wife facade for everyone else. "Your husband looks so good." Cue the polite smile. "You're so lucky." Beam the grateful look. But the fact is, loss that falls short of death is complicated. A therapist told me about ambiguous loss. Something experienced by a quiet club that grieves in the shadows. Women who've miscarried, parents of disabled children or addicted children, people with a chronically ill spouse. The death of a thousand dreams. There are no rituals for that kind of grief, no poems or tributes, no mourning, no resolution. Life plays out in a purgatory of what ifs. "I actually envy you," I confided to my widowed friend one day. Radical honesty being our bond. "You have nowhere to go but up. What if Bob never really comes back?" It's been 13 years, and after a miraculous recovery, Bob is back. He's reporting, speaking Mandarin, traveling to the remote places that fascinate him, and he's heroically peaceful about what wasn't. "How do you know I wouldn't have failed as the anchor?" he jokes, sense of humor restored. I sometimes wonder whether I've been looking at this all wrong. Maybe instead of ambiguous loss, the trick is to be open to ambiguous gain. Like when Bob went to our kids' back-to-school night for the first time in several years, something he'd never been able to do as an anchor. "So this is what I've been missing," he said, sitting in a third grader's cramped desk, reading a note our daughters had left for us. Or the way he started packing lunches, making the ham and cheese sandwiches and slicing apples. Our catastrophe allowed us to raise millions of dollars for injured veterans, and it allowed me to write, not just press kits for kitty litter and plantar wart cream, but essays and books from my heart. When Bob was in a coma, a friend gave me a string of lapis worry beads. I'd clutch them when I couldn't sleep, putting a name to my many worries until I could finally drift off. At a certain point, I renamed them gratitude beads. Now when I'm stressed, I touch each one and name something I'm grateful for. My children's good health, a coven of incredible girlfriends, my able body to hike and garden, my intact husband. And it works. Nothing ambiguous about it at all. Our next article by Stephanie L. King is titled, Gigi Lucas is working to make surfing more accessible to Black girls. There are many scenes a beachgoer is likely to encounter. A couple strolling along the shore with foamy waves bathing their feet. Friends trying to stage the perfect sunset photo. Children building castles or covering relatives with sand. But more unlikely to be seen? A Black woman surfing. One woman with a mission to change that is Gwenna Gigi Lucas. A walking historian about Black people and their issues with the ocean, Lucas is the founder and executive director of Surf Ear Negra, a nonprofit that seeks to diversify the sport of surfing. As a Black woman on a surfboard in Costa Rica, I realized I was the only one, and I started asking myself the question, why? The thought dawned on her after she left 12 years of retail development and international expansion in the fashion industry for brands like Nike and Kate Spade to live a simpler life anchored by surfing in South America. The dramatic lifestyle shift was inspired by just one, her first, surfing lesson in Tamarindo, Costa Rica at the age of 35 during downtime for a friend's destination wedding trip in 2012. I still remember how warm the sun was on my skin and the taste of salt water on my lips. There was a freedom I cannot put into words that, in that very moment, I realized I had not felt in a very long time. Actually, since my childhood, says Lucas, who describes herself as a recovering type A person. Born in Tampa, Florida, Lucas spent her formative years largely on beaches as her parents raced catamarans, went surf fishing, and piled her and her brother into their 1985 Nissan King Cab truck to visit different beaches along the state's coast. Despite being a water baby, however, Lucas never considered surfing until she was an adult, and once she tried it, she was hooked. That's why by 2013, Lucas had traded in her blouses for bare feet after 7 planning trips and guidance from Costa Rican locals and other experts on how to make the move. People would come into my life at the right time. The places I've been just so happen to be perfect timing, she says. It's nothing but God. Her hard-earned corporate savings account also helped fan the financial flame of her journey. But looking back, Lucas says she wished she didn't try to live a New York City lifestyle in Costa Rica at first. A vice for Oreos and Ruffles potato chips does not seem like an expensive habit until you consider high-price imports. I learned quickly that simplicity in all forms is the key to successfully making a transition as big as this one, Lucas says. But even paradise can get lonely. 3 years after moving to Costa Rica, Lucas realized there weren't many Black women in the lineup, which is a term used in surfing for the row of surfers waiting for a wave at any given surf break. Instead, Lucas's lineups consisted of mostly white men, which is generally the case worldwide, especially in the U.S. Even though the ocean is a free resource that doesn't discriminate, somehow surfing has been made to feel exclusive or elusive due to the representation of what a surfer has traditionally looked like, says Lucas. But the ocean doesn't care how good you are, how cute your swimsuit is, or how fancy your board is. No matter who you are, if you're not paying attention and you don't come with a healthy level of fear and reverence, it will humble you, quickly. After reflecting on the lack of diversity in her beloved sport, in 2016, Lucas launched a website to celebrate Black female surfers. 2 years later, she hosted her first event for women of color to connect at a surf competition in Jacksonville, Florida, where she currently resides. Shortly after building a quickly growing community with surfers like her, Lucas realized that while there were an increasing number of platforms like hers showcasing women of color surfers, none were focusing their attention on providing access for the next generation of Black girl surfers. And so Surf Ear Negra was born. Surf Ear Negra's mission is to make surfing accessible to any kid, anywhere, from 7 to 17, with the goal of demolishing the stigmas that keep people of color out of the sea. In her experience, Lucas says the primary barriers are a lack of knowledge of how the ocean works, coupled with the generational traumas inflicted by slavery, Jim Crow laws, and Eurocentric ideas of beauty. I have to physically show many young women that it is okay to wear your hair naturally, says Lucas, who wears sun-bleached locks herself. It is okay to go into the water and be salty and be ashy and have an amazing time and still show up and be your authentic self. Your entire self is okay. Surfer Negra, which in Spanish means black female surfer, partners with over 75 surf camps nationwide to donate spots for girls of color in those communities. So far, after just 2 years, Surfer Negra has been able to send 64 girls to surf camps as they strive for their triple-digit milestone through their 100 Girls program. On land, in 2021, students will also have the opportunity to learn the fundamentals of surfing, both virtually and in person at participating schools, through Surfer Negra's latest project, Surf the Turf, a joint venture with Rocks and Rings Canada. I believe that despite what much of the news may try to portray, this is an exciting time to be alive, Lucas says. The opportunities and possibilities, especially for Black people, are exponentially greater than they were even just one generation prior. So when our girls go through the surf camps, we want them to take the feeling of them paddling in and catching their first wave with them throughout the rest of their lives, wherever they go. Driven by her desire to spread the joy surfing can bring, Lucas is strategic about the partnership she forges to raise funding for Surfer Negra, a key component of her business model. There has been a lot of conversation around allyship lately and organizations amplifying Black voices and the Black experience to increase opportunities for Black people who are overdue and highly deserve the opportunity to shine, she says. Allyship is also the very opportunity that non-Black people need to recognize and learn about the systems in place that created our current reality and how they consciously or unconsciously play a role in it. In response to George Floyd's murder, Surfer Negra partnered with Enact, a sustainable textile brand, to produce a limited edition Black Lives Matter tote bag, with the proceeds going towards surf camp entry costs for young girls of color. One side of the tote features an image from award-winning photographer Malcolm Jackson's Black Beach exhibit of Lucas pictured in Jacksonville, Florida's American Beach. It is a meaningful image. That beach in particular was a safe haven for African Americans because they weren't able to enjoy beaches freely until 56 years ago with the passing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The other side of the tote displays a short poem written by Lucas herself, ending with the message she hopes to send to the world with all of her work. Get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Our next article by Marianne Machescu is Netflix wants us to stop calling movies chick flicks, and I'm with them. What do the films like The Wedding Planner, Bridget Jones' Diary, and 13 Going on 30 have in common? Despite their pop culture status as classics, lighter fare films like these, starring women, are often dismissed as frivolous. But according to Netflix, it might finally be time for us to stop referring to this genre as chick flicks. The streaming site tweeted an interesting proposal. Can we stop calling films chick flicks unless they are literally about baby chickens? Netflix wrote, adding that the term is generally used to describe romantic comedies, which implies that movies that are both romantic and comedic are of sole interest to women. They also nodded to the fact that the description minimizes the amount of work that goes into creating these projects. Romantic comedies and/or films centered around female leads go through just as much editing, consideration, and rewriting as any film, the thread continued. Of course, Twitter had mixed reactions. Many responded with the all-too-expected cry of, "Stick to movies, Netflix!" along with things like PC culture has gone too far. Listen, I get it. There are bigger problems in the world. And there is also irony in the fact that when you Google chick flicks, mostly Netflix movies come up. In fact, as several users pointed out, if you search for chick flicks on Netflix, you'll get plenty of options. Honestly, though, I do think we should hear Netflix out. How many movies can you remember opting out of going to see in theaters because it fell under the chick flick category? Anytime a film has a female lead starring alongside other women, it's automatically implied that the film is of a lower quality than one fronted by a male. In my opinion, the label does in fact further the idea that films starring women can only be one-dimensional. Forget that Bring It On tackled cultural appropriation years before we had the words to express it, or that Legally Blonde followed a law student who stood up against and took over an actual case being led by a professor who sexually harassed her. Because plotlines centered around a journey experienced by a woman are often categorized as silly chick flicks, audiences often miss the positive messages and strong expressive characters these movies gave us. The movie industry as a whole is still largely dominated by men. USC Annenberg reported last year that for every female director in Hollywood, there are 22 men. That dynamic makes it easy for critics, and mostly male critics as it turns out, to write off films that center around women's experiences. Not unlike Elle Woods herself, they're deemed trivial and silly. But why don't comedies starring Adam Sandler get similarly labeled? And as one Twitter user pointed out, the chick flick dynamic could be contributing to the gender inequality cycle in Hollywood. Labeling films starring women as lesser than could be part of the reason hardworking female actresses are offered lesser than salaries, too. Netflix isn't just calling for us to stop using the term chick flick. They're also drawing attention to the fact that this gendered term makes too many assumptions. As the platform noted on Twitter, there aren't categories specifically labeled for men in the way chick flick is. This suggests that a story centered around a male protagonist is universally appealing, whereas a story with a woman protagonist only appeals to other women. It's also a pretty alienating term, implying that you have to fit within the binary, cis-normative restrictions of male and female to enjoy these movies. So the jury is still out on whether Netflix may have been the best platform to speak up about this label. Still, I do commend them for speaking up when no one else was to support films starring women. I look forward to the day characters like Elle Woods and other chick flick leads get the respect and recognition they deserve. As for me, this story has inspired me to go binge some of my favorite classics. See what I did there? Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled Lin-Manuel Miranda Responds to the Hamilton is Canceled Controversy. Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton musical has become an international sensation over the past 5 years, sweeping the 2016 Tony Awards and drawing top dollar for tickets. When the streaming platform Disney Plus unveiled the movie version over a year ahead of schedule, it earned new fans and delighted those who'd only gotten to hear the original cast perform on the original cast recording, aka the soundtrack. But reaching a wider audience also brought a deluge of criticism amid the praise, including concerns about how the work lionized the United States slave-owning founding fathers and didn't accurately portray history. Other Twitter users also took issue with Miranda using the N-word in two audiobooks, once while reading directly from a work by author Junot Diaz, and again while quoting his castmate David Diggs in the pages of his own book about Hamilton. Following a July 3rd viewing party on Twitter, during which Miranda watched along and shared reactions alongside fellow Twitter users, the writer and performer temporarily set his Twitter to private. While that move earned still more criticism from people who evidently wanted Miranda to immediately address the extremely complicated issues at hand on a night that was meant to celebrate Hamilton, he took a beat to formulate a response instead. In a tweet quoting thoughts from writer Tracy Clayton, Miranda acknowledged all the criticisms are valid. The sheer tonnage of complexities and failings of these people I couldn't get, or wrestled with but cut, he continued, referring to the darker sides of the Founding Fathers' history, including the exploitive practice of chattel slave labor. I took 6 years and fit as much as I could in a 2.5-hour musical. Did my best. It's all fair game. The conversation about whether Hamilton is problematic began long before its debut on Disney Plus, even if it's taken on new weight amid the current debate over taking down Confederate monuments and the general whitewashing of American history. The discussion is not just about who lives, who dies, who tells your story, but whose story has gotten told. Perhaps looming largest is the fact that, as the Washington Post explains, While Hamilton was indeed an abolitionist who didn't technically own any enslaved people, his close relationships with fellow founding fathers indicate that he somewhat partook in the system himself. George Washington, portrayed as Hamilton's father figure in the musical, owned nearly half of the over 300 enslaved people at his Mount Vernon home at the turn of the 18th century. Philip Schuyler, the Schuyler sisters' father, owned enslaved people as well. And though slavery is mentioned throughout in Hamilton, there is no enslaved character with a voice in the show. The fact the majority of the cast are people of color playing figures who were white in real life has been subject to debate as well, and not just by those claiming the production's casting call for non-white actors is reverse racism. Basically, what the supposedly colorblind casting does is it gives Hamilton, the show, the ability to say, oh, we're not just telling old white history, historian Lyra Monteiro said in a 2016 Slate interview. This isn't your stuffy old school history book that's just praising white people. Look, we've got people of color in the cast. This is everybody's story. Which it isn't. It's still white history. And no amount of casting people of color disguises the fact that they're erasing people of color from the actual narrative. The counterpoint to that criticism, and one that Miranda has pointed out on his own Twitter feed, is the argument that Hamilton was a star-making vehicle for non-white actors who often had a harder time finding equal opportunities on the Broadway stage. Standout performances earned Tony nominations for Black cast members Leslie Odom Jr., Daveed Diggs, Christopher Jackson, and Renee Elise Goldsberry, as well as Chinese-American actress Philippa Hsu. Hamilton's historical accuracy is the overarching point of debate. Miranda largely based the musical on an Alexander Hamilton biography written by historian Bron Chernow, who acted as a consultant for the show. In a 2015 interview with The Atlantic, Miranda said he chiefly aimed to craft an entertaining story while remaining as true to what happened as possible. My only responsibility as a playwright and a storyteller is to give you the time of your life in the theater, Miranda said then. I just happen to think that with Hamilton's story, sticking close to the facts helps me. All the most interesting things in the show happened. They're not shit I made up. Filmmaker Ava DuVernay is among the Hamilton fans who take issue with the idea that people can't parse our actual history while enjoying a piece of partly fictionalized art. A Broadway musical ain't a history book. I actually read those, DuVernay tweeted in a response to a Twitter user who accused the 13th director of celebrating a slave trader by enjoying the musical. So I understand the difference between a brilliantly rendered play and actual American history. Ultimately, the "Is Hamilton canceled?" debate raises a lot of questions that are difficult to answer. One's both specific to the project itself and about any piece of art that's arguably problematic, yet loved by many. Twitter, where you'll find an ocean of, if you like this bad thing, you are also by extension bad opinions, alongside the valid and thoughtful Hamilton critiques, is one place to broach that conversation, but it shouldn't be the only place we're having it. A lot has happened since the musical was first created and staged, aka the years before the 2016 election. And in a time when non-Black people are being encouraged to consider our own roles in upholding structural racism, Miranda does seem to be trying to do that himself. In May, he apologized for not denouncing white supremacy and supporting the Black Lives Matter movement on the official Hamilton social media platforms earlier. As the writer of this show, I take responsibility and apologize for my part in this moral failure, he said in the video. Hamilton doesn't exist without the Black and brown artists who created and revolutionized and changed the world through the culture, music, and language of hip-hop. Literally, the idea of the show doesn't exist without the brilliant Black and brown artists in our cast, crew, and production team who breathe life into the story every time it's performed. Our next article by Alina Nicolou is Richard Scott Smith of Love Fraud is Still Conning Women. Like the popular Bravo series Dirty John, Showtime's Love Fraud documentary series is the story of how con artist Richard Scott Smith married at least 10 women and defrauded them, often draining their bank accounts in the process. Sabrina Dunlap, a 49-year-old featured in Love Fraud, estimates her debt from Smith totaled $100,000. Jean Hansen, another victim, had to file for bankruptcy after marrying Smith in Vegas and going into business with him. A master of evading the law, Smith has racked up 10 Social Security numbers and 43 phone numbers and innumerable victims over the years. This is a dangerous guy. I think he's Satan's son, Carla Campbell, the bounty hunter featured in Love Fraud, tells OprahMag.com. The main, most chilling difference between Love Fraud and Dirty John? Unlike Dirty John Meehan, who is no longer alive, Richard Scott Smith of Love Fraud is, according to those involved with the documentary, continuing his scheme. He's not done. He's still out there. I've talked to his first wife, and I've talked to his last victim, and he's doing the same thing, Campbell says. Smith left a trail of women victims around the United States, but especially in the Kansas City region. He married at least 10 women and preyed on dozens more. Love Fraud follows what happens when these women band together to track Smith down with the help of Campbell and documentarians Rachel Grady and Heidi Ewing. After hearing about Smith's crimes, Campbell agreed to take on the women's case pro bono. These girls, they just struck a chord with me. I've been through an abusive relationship. I've lost money. I've already been there and did all that stuff, she says. It was just like they need my help because they've got nobody else. In 2018, Smith was arrested in Knoxville, Tennessee, thanks to efforts depicted in Love Fraud. Smith was sentenced to prison and was released in April, per the documentary. According to the filmmaker, Smith was last seen in Kansas. That's the last we heard of him, Ewing says. But the women are keeping track. For years, Smith's victims found the truth and found one another through the Scott the Crook Smith website that Lisa Linton used to document her experience with Smith, her then husband. According to recent comments on the website, Smith has been cited at RV dealerships in the Kansas area and was furloughed due to COVID-19. The site has become a meeting ground for Smith's victims, who swap stories and track the elusive con man's whereabouts. The women were such a good support to me. They had been through it, and they made me feel better. Other people who hadn't been conned asked, "How could you be so naive?" Tracy, who was featured in the documentary, says. Together, the women pieced together Scott's pattern of behavior consistent across his relationships, which he often juggled at the same time. In the beginning, he was very loving. He would bring me roses all the time. All that old-fashioned courtship type stuff. But there comes a point in a relationship where he changes, and it was the same for all of us. He becomes controlling, mean, and aggressive, Tracy says. Sandy, another one of the women featured in the documentary, reportedly had a particularly harrowing experience with Smith after the change that Tracy described. After they became engaged, Sandy said that he physically abused her. She feared for her life. "I think God helped me through, I truly do," Sandy tells OprahMag.com through tears. For the women featured in Love Fraud, participating in the documentary served their broader goals, retribution and saving others. "I wanted to save anybody else from ever having to experience what me and the other women had already experienced," Tracy says. Sandy adds, "We have a crusade. We're not going to stop until we see him behind bars again. That is our end goal." So far, it's working. After the trailer for Love Fraud came out, a woman whose sister was living with Smith reached out to filmmakers. "Oh God, we got to get her out of there," Ewing recalls saying. The relationship ended. As his victims hoped, Love Fraud is functioning as an even more exaggerated version of the blog, which had so bothered Smith. Sandy recalls how, when they were dating, he didn't allow her to Google him. Looking back, she realizes he was afraid of her finding the website. Certainly, widespread notoriety from Love Fraud will make it more difficult for Smith to continue his con. "I definitely think dating might get harder," Ewing says. The billboards of Smith's face currently up in New York and LA and soon to be up in Kansas City won't hurt either. Campbell expects to meet Smith again one day. After the documentary wrapped, Campbell was diagnosed with lung cancer and has had to retire from bounty hunting. Now she's consumed with tracking down Smith and bringing new charges against him. Before all this new stuff with Smith started coming up, I was just sitting here going, well, I hope this is what the end of life it's not like, because I will enjoy my deck, but really I need something to do. Rick gave me purpose, Campbell says. She predicts the hunt for Smith will only grow more complicated as his fame grows. Criminals tend to dive in deeper when there's something going on. If they think there's somebody watching them, they'll go further and underground. I think that's what the show is going to do. It's going to move him further underground. Nobody's going to know where he's at until he's got another victim that comes forward, Campbell says. This much is for sure. She'll be watching. There is more to come. He's not done, Campbell says. Our next article by Deanna Janes is Andrew Cuomo's mom and dad, Mario and Matilda Cuomo, had an incredible love story. She's a force. I'm a lucky man, Mario Cuomo once said about his other half, Matilda Raffa. 6 decades, 5 children, and 14 grandchildren later, we'd have to agree. Their adventure began in college on the campus of St. John's University, where they were both enrolled, and their courtship lasted even through a long-distance stint while Mario indulged his dreams of playing baseball in the minor leagues. Once they married in the mid-1950s, they wasted no time building a family of 5 children. Their 2 sons, Governor Andrew Cuomo and CNN host Chris Cuomo, eventually took the reins as the most prominent Cuomos in the family. Their cheeky sibling rivalry recently went viral when they joked about who mom loves the most. Dubbed a liberal beacon by the New York Times, Mario spent a lifetime fighting for social justice. He died in 2015 with hundreds pouring into his services to pay their respects. Andrew gave a eulogy while Matilda found strength in those around her. The couple, who shared 64 years together, have been described by friends as one of the greatest love stories of all time. Ahead, we're revisiting the pair who were partners in life, love, and activism. 1951, Mario and Matilda meet in college. Per the Daily News, the couple's love story began at St. John's University, more specifically, the cafeteria. Enrolled in the Queens College, Matilda was studying to be a teacher, while Mario focused on law. The New York Times reported that the couple went on their first date to Queens establishment Larry's Bar and Grill, where a strapped Mario put the bill for their meal on his tab. According to both publications, Matilda wore Mario's college ring around her neck on a chain, the equivalent of couples going red carpet or Instagram official today, and she waited for him while he played minor league baseball in Georgia. Times Union reported that Matilda, being the older of the two, supported the pair while he attended law school. Their commitment to each other led their close friends to speak highly of their love. Sandy Frusher, vice chairman of the NASDAQ Group, told the Daily News that this is one of the great love stories of all time, one of the great partnerships of all time. He and his wife, Floss, have been friends with the Cuomos for 40 years. June 5, 1954, they walk down the aisle. Mario purchased the $2,000 diamond ring he put on her finger with a signing bonus he received from playing baseball in the minor leagues, a dream cut short after a freak head injury in 1952. Reportedly, the two kept in touch through pen-palling, with Matilda always looking forward to reading the letters Mario would send while he was away. When his injury holed him up in a hospital for a couple weeks, rendering him unable to write, Matilda had all but written him off. According to an interview with the New York Times, Matilda said, "That's it. He's dead. I never want to see that guy again." Of course, she forgave him. They honeymooned in Puerto Rico and, according to the same Times interview, got pregnant with their first child, Margaret, during that getaway. "She's 39 and I'm married for 40 years, so you figure it out," she teased at the time. Over the years, the couple would go on to have 4 more children. Andrew, the current governor and reigning bachelor of New York. Maria, the wife of fashion designer Kenneth Cole. Madeline, a lawyer, and Chris, the host of CNN's Cuomo Primetime, all of whom were born and raised in Queens. January 1, 1983, Mario and Matilda become the first couple of New York. During his 3 terms as governor, the pair worked in tandem, his public position elevating them both to positions with which to make a difference. They were always a team, and she was able to accomplish so much during his 3 terms as governor, Kevin Layden, who worked closely with Matilda for 10 years, told the Times Union. As Mario became one of the nation's most respected leaders, Matilda was making a name as a fierce advocate for New York families and children. August 5, 2014, they celebrate their 60th anniversary. Months after ringing in their 60th year together, the couple were invited to tour the Albany Medical Center. Hosted by one of Matilda's longtime colleagues, Layden, the tour included an unveiling of a picture honoring Matilda in the newly named Matilda Raffa Cuomo Family Care Corridor. He stopped at the photo and got tears in his eyes. And he said, "You know, she never got the credit she deserved for all she did," Layden said. September 16, 2014, Matilda pours her heart out to Mario on her 83rd birthday. Knowing this could be their last birthday together, Matilda, whose intimate celebration was held at her daughter Maria's Manhattan apartment, took the occasion to address Mario as if they were the only 2 people in the room. She stood up toward the end of the dinner. She looked directly at him the entire time and started talking to him about their lives, their close friend Floss Fruker told the Daily News. She talked about what her life with him had meant to her, how much she loved her life with him and the things they had done together, and what he had helped her be able to do in her own career, mentoring others. The joy that living with him had given her. It was a way of talking to him that was private, poignant, beautiful. It was a lovely honoring of him. Everyone felt it. People cried, including me. January 1st, 2015, Matilda and Mario say their final goodbyes. According to the Times Union, the governor died of heart failure in the couple's Sutton Place home on New York City's Upper East Side in early January 2015. Days later, the former First Lady spent hours greeting hundreds of mourners at the Frank E. Campbell Funeral Home, where folks gathered to pay their respects to the politician and offer their condolences to his widow. His casket, draped with the New York State flag, was accompanied by a black-and-white wedding photo of the couple. Their older son, Andrew, addressed that photo in his eulogy, calling their union a 60-year love affair, adding, "That was not a phony, made-for-TV romance, but a real-life partnership built on respect, love, and tolerance." He later comforted his mother under a light snowfall as his younger brother Chris, an honorary pallbearer, carried Dad down the parlor steps. Our final article by Lane Dalfin is titled, "What Does It Mean When You Dream That You're Being Pushed from a Plane? An Analysis." I dreamed that I was on a plane. The flight attendant approached me to say that I was unloved and then asked me to leave the plane. Next, she tried to push me out the door while the plane was in flight. As she did, I tried to convince her that I'm lovable and have a kind heart. In the dream, I felt sad, alone, and upset, as I know I am lovable. I have a very blessed life, and I'm grateful for my friendships, family, and career, so I honestly don't know where this stemmed from. Signed, In Flight. Dear In Flight, this dream is pushing you. Your nightmare tells a story about someone saying that you're unloved while you don't push back at them. Instead, you protest by trying to convince her that you're lovable and kind-hearted. Since we haven't spoken, I can only venture to say that if you're a person who is uncomfortable in the face of anger, it makes sense for you to have a dream in which you don't push back when negative emotions are coming at you. If you're feeling anger towards someone else, it's possible that you're trying to will those emotions away as soon as you wake up, while reminding yourself of your blessings and gratitude, just as you did in your letter. Is there a recent instance in your waking life in which you felt anger towards someone you're close to? On the other hand, if this anger is coming at you from an outside source, you might be trying to comfort yourself with reminders of the times when you do feel blessed and loved. Turning toward the image of being pushed out of the plane, try to think of a recent situation in which you felt pushed. Was someone you loved rude to you, or did they perhaps behave in a way that makes you feel unloved? We may sometimes feel attacked by those we're close to, even when the attacker may still love us deeply. In fact, looking at the plot, if you want to narrow down who might have been rude to you, you could begin by looking for a person in your life who is normally helpful and accommodating, like a flight attendant would be, who has behaved in a completely unexpected way towards you. Here's an alternate scenario. Ask yourself, is someone I love attempting to push me to do something I don't want to do? Your dream's imagery may be attempting to point that feeling out through a play on words. The most poignant part of the dream is how, when the attendant tries to push you from an airborne plane, the only defense you put up is trying to convince her that you are lovable and have a kind heart. If this happened in waking life, your response would be much more forceful. In this dream, your healthy unconscious mind is begging you to push back, big time. So in whatever way you're being pushed, whether someone you care about is being rude to you or making you feel unloved, moving you to anger, or urging you to do something you don't want to do, this dream is telling you to take the focus off your blessings for a moment and emphatically stand up for what you want and need. This is an example of what I call a rehearsal dream. It sets the stage for you to react by creating such a horrific situation it almost leaves you no choice but to respond. In your waking life situation, adopt some of the flight attendant's pushiness into your own response. As represented in the actions of the flight attendant, you're literally pushing the over-accommodating part of yourself away when you stand up for your own needs. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.